listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. I've got a wonderful guest coming up, and she set up and runs an organisation called Let Kids Be Kids. And it's hard to imagine, is it not, that here in this wonderful country, New Zealand, we actually need an organisation to let kids be kids and to argue for it. Her name is Penny Marie. I have to declare a conflict of interest because I think she's wonderful and I think she's doing God's work here on earth, and I am happily a little soldier in her building army of an organisation of Let Kids Be Kids. So total conflict of interest. Penny Marie, good morning.
Good morning, Rodney. Well, that's a bit of an intro, isn't it?
Well, I always feel I have to sort of be honest, but I'm in awe of you and I think you're amazing.
Oh, feelings mutual, and it's a privilege to have become such good friends over such a difficult time and topic, isn't it?
Indeed, and maybe it's those difficult times and difficult topics that do make us appreciate people more.
Mm. Yeah. The authenticity, right?
Well, if you step out like you have stepped out in public, you take a irrevocable step and you have to know that you've got a good heart and good motives to survive the lies and the attacks that I know you have had to withstand.
Mm.
It's extraordinary. I actually regard this protecting of our kids from hypersexualization in schools and gender ideology. It's like the COVID scare, but on speed.
Yeah.
Because the lies and the gaslighting are just as severe. But the consequences are existential in the sense that they could wipe out our young people's ability to function as fathers, husbands, mothers, wives, and carers of children.
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, the COVID thing is crazy. The so-called vaccination thing is crazy, and it causes harm and it causes death. And it's the same issue, right, of not having full and informed consent because you don't have all of the truth. But there are, people who get sick with some of that stuff can rectify that through changing their health and taking things. But if you mutilate a child's body, if you get to the point where the child believes that they're born in the wrong body and they have taken medication and or surgical steps to try and think that if they're born in the wrong body, then if they do that, that's the right body for them. They can't reverse that. And also they can't reverse the destruction of their psychological well-being. So we have a responsibility as adults to speak the truth on this. Our children need us to.
And of course, I've come to realise through you and your presentations you've done around New Zealand that it's not just the extreme edge of kids having, quote, gender-affirming surgery, which is the mutilation of their bodies. It is actually all kids who are being taught that identity is fluid and that girls and boys are interchangeable. That is not destructive of the body like the gender surgery, but it's destructive of your mind.
Yeah, and you know what they do? They talk all the time about breaking down gender stereotypes. Now, We were all just trucking along being who we were. There are men and there are women, and there are some men that are effeminate and some women that are masculine, and we all knew that. We all just got on with it. And now they start labelling everything that is not what they want to say as they want to challenge all the norms. And they want to, they talk about stereotypes. So they're forcing extreme stereotypes. They're forcing the fact that society says that all men must be entirely masculine and all women must be entirely feminine, but that's not true. And so then everyone's confused. But they're the ones telling the lot. They're the ones creating that extremeness. You know, we always knew that some males
always
are more feminine and some females are more masculine, and that's fine. They have created that story, and then they're weaponizing it against the people that actually know what's true. That's insane.
It's a strange thing. I grew up in the 1960s in a small town, Rangura, North Canterbury, and we had a Māori pā, what we called the Māori pā, down the road at Tuahiwi, and we had lots of Māori at school. And there was never an issue.
Yeah.
And in fact, all I wanted to be was a Māori, because they had big brothers that would look after them and they could roam freer and they were tougher than everyone else. I wanted to be a Māori. Mm. And we had one Māori boy who was effeminate. And he'd spend lunchtime and playtime. I can remember him making daisy chains, literally, when everyone else was playing rugby. And no one teased him. No one bothered him. He was just, we were polite.
Mm.
And supposedly it was all a hellscape. You know, back then, it was actually very respectful because we had manners, and you were taught to respect other people.
Mm. Yeah, that's that basic humanity that that Elizabeth speaks of with her stuff on our tour. Is we knew how to do that. It's actually adults that impose these so-called divisions on the children, you know, whether it's racial, whether it's sexual, whatever it is, they're imposing it through something. So through policy, through rules, through the narrative, through whatever it is that they're using as their tool. Kids don't look at each other at that young, innocent age and categorize, label, you know, they don't. They do earlier now because it's pushed upon them, not because that's naturally who they ever were.
I get a bit of pushback from listeners on this topic, and I've reflected on that a lot. Pushback in the sense that I over-dramatise it. I believe I under-dramatise it. And I think the difference is this. To understand what is happening, you almost have to have children in the system.
Yeah.
Not only do you have to have children in the system, you have to take a great deal of effort and a little bit of courage to find out what is actually going on in the schools.
Yeah.
So my experience is literally 99% of parents at my children's school have no idea what is going on. I summarize it for them in, say, a column and send it to them, and they literally don't believe it. And it's straight out of the teaching guide.
Yep. They've made us all very busy, haven't they? Very busy and distracted, and meanwhile trusting external systems because we're too busy to look and check on them.
Meanwhile, our children at, say, my daughter's case at 13, is being taught how to give consent when she legally can't.
Yep.
How to submit to sex of what I would call a little bit perverse, because they've got to be inclusive and take into account all types of sex. So she's got to learn at 13 how to protect herself for homosexual sex if she were a boy, sodomy, and lesbian sex if she was a lesbian girl. All this is being thrust upon her at 13. She's a 13-year-old girl struggling through puberty.
You know what I also wonder about that is that it must really mess up their friendships. So if you live in a world where most people are heterosexual, then and you're heterosexual, then your same-sex friends are your safe zone, right?
Mm.
Do you understand? So yes, if you're a girl and you're hanging out with girls, you would have thought generally that they're a safe zone from sexual predatory behaviour. But when they break down all of those, constantly break down all of those messaging, and there's no boundaries anymore, where is the safe space for a girl or a boy amongst their peers of the same sex? Because they don't know who's safe. That's a whole nother aside thing that I think about.
No, it's absolutely the case. And, of course, they teach a distance between parents and children.
Yeah.
So you're not to talk to your parents about what's going on.
Hmm.
And, of course, I have this funny fixation with Christopher Luxon because I think he's so totally useless. And I'll never forget him saying that if you want to debate toilets, you're on another planet. And I don't want to be talking about toilets either, actually. But the reality for my daughters and all their friends is they can't go to the toilet at school.
What's the situation at school with the toilets at your daughter's school? Is it
all unisex?
All unisex, okay.
The boys be boys and piss all over the seat.
Mm.
They go and do a dump and don't shut the doors because they think it's funny that the girls have to walk past.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. They say it is totally disgusting if you want to go to the toilet.
Wow. Yeah. You think back to a year ago when Luxon said that, because I remember him saying that too. And, you know, he needs to eat his words on that because we don't have a safe space for our children. And that's disgusting. We shouldn't even, like you say, having to talk about it. But if they keep lowering the bar, people are going to keep meeting that bar. You know, our young boys have toilet humour. They've always had toilet humour. I've got sons. You know, toilet humour is funny and whatever. But they keep lowering the bar. And so now it's just making a mockery of safe spaces and actually dignity. There's no dignity there, right?
No dignity, no modesty.
No.
No femininity. Absolutely destroyed.
Mm.
And I can see the effect it is having on my girls.
Imagine the effect it's having on those on the boys as well, because they'll grow up into a society where they think that all of that's acceptable behaviour, or whether they know that it's not acceptable, but they see that they get by with it.
Yes.
Lowering the disrespect. Bar.
I actually can't see, funnily enough, my oldest girl, she is almost retreating as an act of defiance and rebelness into being a 1950s feminine woman, right? My girls won't swear.
Mm-hmm.
They're Christians. They dress modestly. They won't flaunt themselves. And I can imagine them. In fact, their ideal are those sort of 1950s glamour women, not these androgynous skinny things with tattoos. And I'm wondering if there might be a bit of a kickback on that. And they talk about marriage. So it's a funny thing because they're the sort of rebels in the school.
Isn't that crazy that they've become the rebels? We need more of that.
Totally crazy.
Mm. We need those. So, we need children like your daughters to be supported in their choices. That's the thing, is that, you know, well, it used to have different choices, but people with morals, even if some people might consider that to be too conservative, they should be supported in being who they are. Why is it that you can only be supported in being who you are if you think you're born in the wrong body or you're a victim of something? What about all the other people who just want to be them?
In the curriculum for my daughter's school, the message was very plain. If you're heterosexual, boring. If you're non-binary, that's awesome. That's the word that's used. That is so awesome.
Wow.
You are amazing. You're non-binary. The entire messaging is you're special. You're wonderful. It's like this. I got a friend who explains it, that it's like a pendulum. And so he thinks that they're keeping homosexuals in the closet. There had to be, the pendulum had to swing the other way. And I don't accept that. But that is exactly what it is, that to be binary, in their words, that is to say heterosexual, is ho-hum. And it's awesome, because your job is to be who you are, your true self, your true identity. And even most awesome of all would be if you were born a boy, but you've decided you're a girl. Now tell me, I say all this as a preamble because I can't stress enough what a dangerous time this is and what we're doing to our children, and how they're ever going to cope into adulthood and find their way through. How did you get into this, Benny? I first came across you when it went viral. Your speech to the Board of Trustees went absolutely viral, and I watched it and listened to you speak, a mother talking to the Board of Trustees, of whom you'd been a member. You were so brave, and yet you spoke the plain truth. That was the start of this?
So I'd already been doing research and other things as far as, you know, on this side of the fence post-COVID, what was going on in the world. I didn't know how big this topic was when I did my board speech. I knew that what was going on overseas looked really bad, and I was trying to find it here in New Zealand, like lots of people. And when you started to see that it was hard to find, that was a bit of a warning bell. But also I'd learnt a lot along the way about how not to react to things. So how to go in courageous, calm, not argumentative and asking questions. And that's just something that we have all, I think, by now, most of us, learned to apply in whatever area we're concerned about. You know, just throwing rocks isn't going to get you anywhere. And so I just tried to show just my way of how I would do that to try and help. But I didn't realize quite how big of a rabbit hole I was about to fall down until people started contacting me. And then I saw that it was, you know, a big thing, and that people hadn't got their voice, or parents didn't have their voice. So it just kind of snowballed from there. But I think too, the more that you choose to speak about something, the more that you must have the evidence that you're to back up what you're saying. So then you just end up becoming a researcher, like so many of us have, of like, I've got to see that. I can't just make a flippant comment about something. I've got to see the data. So asking questions has become so important, and gathering evidence of everything. And I'll relate that to something that was in one of the documents that we just are going to discuss. But knowing for yourself that you're not crazy and what you're seeing is actually really going on. So just becoming super hungry for actual evidence and actual information. And then for me, what I found was the next thing is, once you sit with that evidence, you need to find your confidence that you can actually, of what it is that you're actually seeing. that you can actually articulate it and present it in a way that helps other people to understand, but also so that for yourself you can go, I'm not crazy here, I am seeing this. Because we've all had to do this, right? We've all trusted systems and just assumed that they had our best interests at heart. And then when you start to come against stuff and you're like, maybe I'm nuts, like this can't be happening. And that's what we get all the time, right? Like you say, people think you overplay it. You're like, maybe I am crazy, because surely not. So then you just have to keep asking and you have to keep getting the information. And then you just go, no, I definitely know what I'm seeing here. And then you talk to other people about it and they're feeling the same. And I think seeing people sort of know that something's off but not have the confidence to know what to do about it drives me, because we need everybody to do something, even if it's just for your own children. But a lot of parents that I know and grandparents that are in this space now, they're doing it because they look around them and, like you, they see so many other families that are blissfully unaware. And so they're in the fight for all of the children, not just their own children. And, you know, just massive ups to all the parents and grandparents and ex-teachers and everyone who speaks up, because our children need us to.
You've also been traveling around the country doing your presentation with the absolutely magnificent and wonderful Elizabeth Cave with her presentation. And so you have built a network and your network is growing. So you will be getting a lot of information too from parents and their actual experiences.
That's the key thing, is talking to people and seeing the same thing going on and then being able to help one another, connecting people together so that people feel supported, because you are up against a big beast here and we're all just trying to nut this out ourselves. So the being connected with each other and sharing our stories, sharing our evidence, sharing our information, to me is the only way that I can see that we get through this, because we've been siloed for a long time and we need to break down those silos and work together. Mm. So, yeah, when I go around and talk to people, I'm receiving so much information, which helps me then be able to speak with some authority on it. Mm.
I find Let Kids Be Kids, your organisation, to be the exact equivalent of Voices for Freedom.
Mm.
And the COVID years, you're alone thinking you were going crazy and you realize now that you're being gaslit.
Yeah.
And with this, you start looking at what they're doing to your kids and you're thinking, this can't be happening. I must be crazy. Everyone else seems cool with this. And then you find this network and then you realize this is actually happening to our kids.
Yeah.
And then the difficulty with it is you start looking into it and it becomes like peeling the onion, because you start off thinking, well, this is just a bad curriculum, you know, just need to change the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
But then you realize that it's right through everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a deep, dark philosophy. And you get to the point where even I start to hear myself talk or think, and I sound nutty to myself, because I can't imagine what is wrong with these people that do this to children. Like, let kids be kids, you know? And yet there are these adults who want to destroy them. And you can't, and let's get into specifics. These adults have received damehoods, millions and millions of dollars.
Yes.
They're extremely well educated. I'm thinking of Sue Bagshaw.
Yep.
Who's an elderly lady now, but who thinks that putting prepubescent girls on puberty blockers and cutting off their nascent breasts is healthcare.
Yeah.
How do you get your head there as a doctor? Like, I can't begin to comprehend it. And then get knighted and get millions of dollars and become seen as a wonderful, caring person, opening all these drop-in places for kids who are troubled to come to and be twisted.
And she's married and have four children. So anyone who's in this, who has their own children, they need to be called out on the fact that what they're pushing will stop other people from having children, from having the very thing that they had.
You and I have met parents who've had this done to their children.
Yep.
And the parents are so destroyed that we can't name them. But there have been kids who the parents are told, you have to do this, take these drugs, do the surgery, otherwise your kid will kill themselves. So they're beaten and bullied into it. And the kids lose the ability to have their own children, to have a functioning relationship. And many lose their own, take their own lives.
Mm.
We know this. Not reported. And still we see these people being fated.
Mm.
And Chris Luxon and Minister of Education, Erica Stanford, and a newly minted, we've never had it before, Minister of Mental Health, Matt Doocy, support all of this every inch of the way.
Yep. 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 It's so deep and dark. And you can see the more you look across all parts of society. So outside of education, you look at workplace policies, you look at rules for things, you look at criteria for for grants and things. It's the Trojan horse of language and DEI, or diversity, equity, inclusion. So the Trojan horse is how they've done this through language. And then they've applied that into policy. They've applied it in, they're trying to get gender into the human rights. They've applied it into legislation. They've applied it across the way so that they have shifted society into believing this stuff, because it is everywhere. Everything
it's,
I pick
it's an
up
amazing,
has it.
It's an astonishing achievement and coup.
Yeah.
Because what I've seen through your research is just how few people affected it.
Yeah.
And yet they did it in a way that was impossible, almost, for an organization or a corporation to oppose. Oh, do you believe that everyone should have a fair go? Yeah, of course I do. Oh, well, so you believe in inclusion? Of course I do. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll give you the rainbow tick or the pride pledge, but here you just have to sit, you know, pay us some money and sit these things and put your staff through this, and then suddenly you're on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you've promoted people within the organization to oversee the rainbow tick and the pride pledge. Suddenly you're the police who want to be inclusive, who want to be doing the socially accepted thing. And suddenly you have an activist who's now writing the policy for the police. And suddenly an elderly woman is being beaten by trans activists, and the police stand down and watch.
That's how it's happened. Yeah.
And we now have paedophiles, rapists of children, who have transitioned to be women and are accepted by the authorities as women and able to enter female changing rooms and toilets.
And prisons.
And prisons and hospital wards.
Yep.
And if we stop them, well, first of all, if we complain, it's hate speech.
Yep.
And if we physically stop them, which I will do, we will be arrested.
Mm-hmm. You have to wonder how far more society needs to fall to wake up.
Well, it's been clever because it's been bit by bit. And they've got the young people. And the young people scream at us.
Yes.
Like the little red guards.
Yeah.
Because they are lost almost.
And they've had it drummed into them too, that their rights, about their rights, and that what that means is what they think they know with their young brains is more important than those around them with more wisdom, whether it's parents or teachers or authority members. You know, they're being shown and told everywhere that they know the best for them.
Mm.
And that's never going to end well.
And of course, we were brought up, I was brought up that I knew nothing, to sit down and shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was absolutely great because you learned a lot.
Yeah.
But we have little 5-year-olds who this dame says, no, they're in the wrong body.
And the logic of that doesn't even make sense. If you think that you're in the wrong body and then you create a fake version of what you want to be, which is never going to be what you, an actual real attempt at being the opposite, what if you then decide that you're in the wrong body? Like if you decided that once, what's to say that after making drastic changes that you're solid in that?
No, because you can't change your mind.
No, that's right. And so, anyway.
And it's impossible to be born. I'm actually wondering if the Olympics with those two boxers is a turning point, because that's been so peculiar.
Yes.
And even people on our side have been confused by it, because they say, oh, no, apparently, I don't know, one of the boxers wasn't she born and she didn't have a penis and like she was raised a girl and it's on her passport, so it's sort of like not really a trans person because she was assigned. And you say, no. Yes, there was a physical deformity, but he's XY. And here's the thing. The crowd that are promoting this have always told us that what you are born doesn't count. Right?
Yeah.
You can be born a boy. Ah, that's just some arbitrary doctor.
Mm.
Right, but now they're hanging their hat on that they thought, apparently, I don't believe even that, was born a girl, so therefore, ipso facto, has to be a girl forever. No, you've just been telling us exactly. But of course, this is the process of destroying our confidence, ever a shifting argument.
It's if you've got humanity questioning the fundamentals of the nature around who we are, which is we are either male or female, and what that conversation there is that there are a very small percentage of the population that are born with atypical genitalia called intersex, and they've tried to wrap that into this whole gender fluid topic. But there's still only male and female, right? And so when you have humanity questioning that amongst themselves and arguing amongst themselves and thinking that they can be different, there's not much further we can go into oblivion from that. That is a fundamental of humanity in order to procreate and to keep our species alive. We need male and female. You know, there were no other animals in the animal kingdom that would think it was sane to have the conversations that we're having, because we... It is known for nature that that's how species survive. So I just want to get to the point where it's not even a conversation anymore and we get back to some common sense.
Mm. Do you get scared sometimes for yourself?
I don't get scared for myself at all because I speak the truth and I know I'm doing what I'm here to do. I get despairing of humanity in the sense that I think if you can't see what they're doing, and we've tried to help, like there's people out there like us who talk about it all the time to bore people to death with it. If you don't want to see, I got nothing else for you. I don't know how to make you see. You don't want to see, but that's going to go badly for you. So I fear for those around me not seeing the truth and if we don't have enough numbers to understand it to be able to resolve. But I don't personally fear for me. Who shall I be afraid of if you speak the truth and you've got the evidence and you've got good people around you? Yeah,
it's always bad to jump to Nazi Germany. But take living under Joseph Stalin and say East Germany or Soviet Russia or Germany in the 1930s or Pol Pot or Mao Zedong. There have been extraordinarily in recent times bleak periods within societies. And you can imagine seeing it for what it was and seeing no end to it.
Yeah.
But humanity came through.
Yeah.
And I take some heart from this. I was initially thinking that no one's ever confronted anything like this. And in a way, that's true. But we've certainly confronted very dark times.
Mm-hmm.
And humanity, that little spark, because they can't crush you, Penny. They literally can't crush you. It's amazing when you think of it. Now, we got on because I put in an Official Information Act request, which I do occasionally, hardly read it, and sent it off to you. And then you were excited by what it was found. So tell me about my Official Information Act request and why it's interesting.
Okay, so you got a you put an Official Information Act request into the Minister of Education, Erica Stanford, and you received it back last week on the 31st of July. So she raises a few things, but she also provided two appendices. So one of them was from the Ministry of Education.
I'll just interrupt because the only thing that shocked me, and I expected it, so this is why I did the OIA. I did the OIA to see if she'd done anything to give effect to the New Zealand First National Coalition Agreement, which is a signed agreement that forms the government. Now, I know a bit about these because I've signed them and I've enforced them. So John Key and I signed a coalition agreement in 2008. And that was the basis of our government. And I regarded it as written in blood. And to be fair, so did John Key. And so that was our treaty. And we would refer to it. And we would honour it. And we respected it. So this agreement is what makes Erica Stanford a minister. Winston Peters has already walked out of one government because of an arguable failure to follow the coalition agreement. That was when Jenny Shipley became prime minister and they proceeded to allow the sale of shares in Wellington Airport. And he'd signed an agreement with Jim Bolger saying no privatisation of state assets. And if I recall correctly, Jenny Shipley was trying to get around it because I think the shares were held by a council. But Mr. Peters didn't see it that way, and he collapsed the government.
Mm.
He saw it as an opportune time as well. And we ended up as the ACT Party propping Jenny Shipley up so she could stagger through to the election. So that was a key moment in MMP history about the significance of a coalition agreement. Within the agreement that National has with New Zealand First is the promise to dump and replace the relationship sexuality education curriculum, which is the one that is so horrific, copied and pasted from the UN's recommendation. Yeah. I asked what advice the minister had received in 9 months and what advice she'd asked for and what advice she'd received.
Mm.
She wrote a whole lot of stuff, included some appendices, but the answer is none. If you're a minister and you haven't actioned something within the 9 months, I would actually say within 4 months of getting your warrant, it ain't going to happen that term.
Mm.
And this is complicated because schools are 50% of schools or more are using this curriculum. You've got to dump it and put in a new one. She's done nothing.
Mm.
Mr. Peters would be quite justified in saying, not good enough, she goes.
Yeah.
This is tough stuff that's going on. So that was my point. She included some bumf, and this is your point, the bumf. So tell me what you found in these appendices.
Well, just before I do that, I just want to, there's a piece that I include into our roadshow which talks about the sexualization of children in schools has happened before in history, and like, and you've talked about some different places, but Hungary is one example in 1919 where they put the sexualization of children, including like how to masturbate and all of that, into young children, into the school curriculum. Now, when I spoke to someone in Greece about this last year and I asked him what happened, and he said that they were trying to dismantle traditional family values, which had, you know, family at the centre. And so that's the tool that they use, is sexualisation of children. And I asked him what happened, and he said the family unit was too strong. But actually, when I read an article about it recently, it says this: however, the experiment was short-lived because the government fell. So this is the point at which we may be at. This may be the topic which exposes it for what it is. So we'll just leave that there. And
that's
I'll
a great
just,
point.
Yeah, it is, because it's exposing the level of corruption when they want to sexualize the children, is sexualizing the children is so that the state can raise them and the children are separate from the family, which is never going to be good for society. So in this OAA response, she has this document called a rapid response. So in fact, in December last year, she obviously had asked the Ministry of Education to provide her with what's called factual bullets on the background of RSE, and also about the Aotearoa histories, because that was being asked, but that's out of scope for this. So we'll just focus on the RSE. And the second bullet point says, schools have the flexibility to design their local curriculum, including their RSE curriculum. This means that while RSE is guided by the national curriculum, it will differ from school to school, and there is no compulsory topics that must be addressed. So the Ministry of Education told her that in December last year, as we were going into the summer holidays. From my point of view, that's a death knell, really, because she knew before school went back that there are no compulsory topics. Now, she's tried to backtrack a little bit, and I guess that she has a big cleanup job to do to get her head around how those curriculum RSE guidelines have played out. But from what parents are understanding and what's in schools, is that teachers, heads of department for health, and principals, as far as they know, believe that the topics are compulsory. And so they're including the questionable bits about consent, about pornography, about the challenging gender norms and all of the gender identity, gender ideology, which is questionable, you know, and not scientific. So what is actually being said to her back in December is that those topics are not compulsory. Now, we're in August and we've had another year of most schools have put or are putting their RSE curriculum out. And when parents have asked and questioned them on this, they just get told that that's what's in. And they say that they're following the New Zealand curriculum to do so. So there's a mismatch there. And I believe, from what I'm seeing, that it would have been quite easy for a memo to have gone out to the principals of all the schools. And I don't believe, well, they talk about remove and replace, you know, and we put a Substack out about this last week. Not many parents would be jumping up and down if it was removed and not replaced quickly. They want it removed quickly. They don't need it to be replaced quickly. No, children are going to be harmed in having those topics gone for a while the dust settles and we figure out the mess that was created with the previous government. That's the way that I look at that. So, the other side of that comment is it talks about local curriculum and that schools should be looking at it from a local point of view. Now, there's been a massive push, and we talk about it a lot with the Navigating the Journey resources, for schools to buy off-the-shelf resources or to have external agencies come in and teach their kids these topics. So what this statement says is that they have the flexibility to design a local curriculum. To me, that means local being relevant to the local community, right? Which means mm-hmm. that they need to have consultation, true consultation with the parents. And they don't. A lot of them have missed their two-year consultation rounds. And then the ones that we know that have, it appears to be a tick box exercise, and they receive the consultation information, and only a few parents ever bother to send it through. They miss it, or they trust the school or whatever, for whatever reason. And then nothing changes anyway. Nothing appears to change between what they propose to put in versus what they put in after the consultation. So I actually feel like what they've done here is created this situation where they're all pointing the finger at each other, or they will be pointing the finger at each other if someone's brave enough to go them, is who harmed my child?
Yes.
Who made that decision to put that information into the school curriculum that my child saw that then created some problems? Is it the teacher? Because the teacher will say they're following the New Zealand curriculum. Is it the people that wrote the curriculum? Is it the Ministry of Education? Is it the Ministry of Education? Is it the principal? Is it the Board of Trustees? Who is responsible?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about how they do that answer. Because what they've done is removed any responsibility.
Yep.
But of course, you and I know that the ultimate responsibility rests with the board.
That's right.
And the boards have to accept that responsibility. And I met, as you know, with the board chair of my daughter's high school, Wakatipu High School. Lovely, lovely guy. Total gentleman. There for all the right reasons. Until I came along, he had no clue.
Yeah, that's right.
And why would he?
Well, this is the difference between governance and operational, right? So This is what I learned on the board. And when I went and did my board speech, they genuinely didn't know. They didn't know. They don't know the detail of what's in the curriculum because everybody trusts everybody while everybody's in a silo. So the board won't know unless they're asked and they require to go and find some answers out as to what's going on. The principal doesn't usually even know because they're trusting the health team to do the best. Right?
Yes. And of course, they're professionals, quote. They're teachers, quote. I'll go a little step further. I don't think the principal knew.
No.
Would that be your experience too?
Yep. Principals are aware of the RSE guidelines. And I've been told by a principal that like it just appeared on the desk and they were told they had to do it. This is a year or so ago now. So, but that doesn't mean that they're aware of what's being taught in class unless they ask the question. So, but the board is PCBU. They're the person conducting a business or undertaking. So
yeah, that's right.
The buck stops with whoever's in charge.
And in my case, the teacher in charge is the head of the PE department, which is a relatively junior position in the scheme of things, and therefore under 40, and therefore steeped in this ideology, and have been off to teacher's college where they've been double steeped in it. And you know that they regard a parent such as I as a dinosaur. To be skirted around and dismissed.
Yeah. And there's a lot in that. It seems to be for a long time that school staff are encouraged to see parents like that, like part of the problem. Vexatious is one of the words that seems to come up. And it's like, well, no, we're the parent. You're trying to tell me that you've got more right than I have around what my child is going through. Shall we continue on through a couple of other things of this? So in the same document, this rapid response from the Ministry of Education, they actually answer, they say who developed it, as in the RSE guidelines, and it says the Ministry of Education contracted the University of Auckland to refresh the RSE guidelines and lists some of the people that were involved. Now, one of them, and I'd like to talk to you more about this perhaps another day, but one of them is Dr. John Finnelty. So he's high up in the University of Auckland. Now, if you look him up, and I would recommend that people go and look for yourselves and don't just trust me.
How do you spell his name?
John Finnelty. Finnelty is F-E-N-A-U-G-H-T-Y. And he is a head of, I think he's social sciences or something, but he gets a lot of money to conduct a lot of research. Now, you'll see his name pop up on all the surveys that they reference when they talk about this high need for dealing with the rainbow community. So I see a merry-go-round with the universities, and in particular Auckland University, where they get paid to conduct research, which I believe is weighted to give what they want to have say, and then they use that research to write the guidelines, create the problem, create the solution. So that's one issue. And then they go on to say, the writers group used an advisory made up of people from Australian universities and also and with stakeholders including, get this list, family planning, the School Trustees Association, which should be parent voice but isn't because they just get told what to do, Intersex New Zealand, Rainbow Youth Inside Out, and the Human Rights Commission, which we know are lobbying to keep all of this stuff in, and the Chief Censor of New Zealand Health Education. So what they've done, from my mind, is they've loaded the bases. This is for consulting around the current RSE guidelines that are in. They have a loaded base of people that want this narrative to become the norm as the people that are consulting for the RSE guidelines. That's a massive coup to understand for sure and have that information from the Ministry of Education as to who inputted into the guidelines in the first place. So you start to see why it's completely rainbow washed.
Rainbow washed. I've just got John Finnelty's bio. Let me read it. This is from the university. So this is what he's written. My background in community psychology pivots around youth well-being, particularly as it is impacted by victimization, harassment, and or cis heteronormativity, including within schooling and education settings. So being normal, being heterosexual, is harassing, or you can give harassment. I've straddled academia and community work since my undergraduate days in psychology and education and transitioned from full-time community work to academic employment in 2015. My community work began in 1997 when I founded the university's first Queers on Campus support group, which in turn prompted my mixed methods master's research on suicide risk and resiliency among gay and bisexual men in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Having then worked in London in youth development, I returned to Auckland to act as a principal investigator on a New Zealand Health Research Council, NZFIST, and Lotteries Health funded project, exploring how men who have sex with men understood and experienced forced, pressured, and unwanted sex. I took this knowledge around sexual and violence, infused with a feminist-informed Foucauldian perspective, into my role as research manager and helpline coordinator at NetSafe. So, interesting, but he's what you would say an advocate at the extreme fringe of the issues with which we're dealing with. And yet he's the guy that's become pivotal in this.
Well, not only that, Rodney, but he is also the one, you will find him everywhere. So he's behind Rainbow Youth and Inside Out. So he is the facilitator of the training videos or the videos that Inside Out uses. You can find them on the Rainbow Youth website. You can also find them on the Ministry of Education's TKI website under Inclusive. He's everywhere. So to me, that's a conflict of interest. He's getting funded, and further down on the page that you're looking at, you can see a whole lot of numbers there. So distinctions and honours. He gets given 70K, 100K, 100K, 26K, another 100K to go and do a whole lot of research on this. So he creates the surveys and creates the numbers, which then drives policy and which you can see what's going on. I can see what's going on here. So the fact that he's one of the key people that developed the RSE guidelines, you can see why it's hard to have a conversation about heterosexual biological fact.
Yes.
It's very ideological.
Yes.
And it's very well-funded ideological. So that's just, he's just one example. So So just going back to the document. So he's just one of the people. He pops up everywhere. So he's a key person in the research that drives it all. But then they talk about the group being used, which is family planning. So that's, you know, Dame Sue Bagshaw, Intersex New Zealand, Rainbow Youth.
And family planning are an extremist organisation now.
So they're connected with Planned Parenthood, and they are very pro they're not called family planning anymore. They're called sexual wellbeing Aotearoa. And I think that's a more accurate thing because they're not about the family at all. They're about abortions. They're about contraception. They're about gender affirming care. So everything that is not about procreation in nature, you'll find that at Sexual Wellbeing Aotearoa. So they are one of the stakeholders. And then you've got Rainbow Youth and Inside Out, which, they're connected to John Finnerty. So they're creating this little bubble of people that are the people that are driving these guidelines. And then it said the content was tested with teachers and for feedback and included the 2019 Youth Advisory Group. Now, I went online the other day and looked up the Youth Advisory Group and for the current one, and I can see briefly when I looked that they handpicked young people who are not the majority of the population. Yes. So they're immigrants, yes. They're people with victim stories, and there was people from the LGBT community in there. That's the group that they've handpicked. So all of the stuff is curated. None of it is happening organically. It's very obvious to me what's going on. So that's in one of the documents. Now, I just want to call out one of the other things in this document. So this, again, is the rapid response from the Ministry of Education. They've got a heading here, general challenges, and it says, while RSE has been contentious throughout its history in the curriculum, the Ministry has seen an intensification and proliferation of misinformation and disinformation relating to RSE and the Ministry's guidance over the last year. This was written in December last year. The Ministry is aware of several cases of doctored images which use Ministry logos and colours that have been widely shared on social media. Many of these contain information that is factually inaccurate and designed to provoke anger or disapproval. Now, there you see the drop-in of the misinformation, disinformation yes. project, and they're trying to say that people who are questioning what they're doing are creating misinformation and disinformation and misrepresenting them. Now, I would hand on heart say, we don't need to doctor any images. We have the images. We have the documents. We've downloaded them from your website. We've purchased them online. We've got the evidence on you. It's not misinformation and disinformation, but of course, as soon as they say that, it gets disregarded and the media won't pick it up.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I wrote a column on navigating the journey for year 9 students.
Hmm.
And I didn't even know how to write it because it was so, I don't like to use the word, no, graphic. And what's the word? It's not disgusting. It's just so blunt.
Explicit.
Explicit. Yeah. You know, it's like I learned stuff, right? And you don't have to make it up. Like I was trying to work out how to present it in a way that was less brutal than it was being presented to a class of 13-year-old boys and girls by a male teacher. I was trying to soften it for my audience because it was so shocking to be written down. Could you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Could you write off to the ministry an Official Information Act request and ask them for the examples of that misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, that's what I was going to do.
And ask them how much it was shared. I guarantee you they have none.
No, I would say that they have none. Yeah.
And they will give you a reason. And what I'm going to do, because you've just given me an idea, I'm going to fire off an Official Information Act request to our Prime Minister and ask him for any communications he's had, whether by text or emails or phone calls or meetings, with the Minister of Education to get her to dump the RSE.
Yeah. Well, so can I move on to the second appendix that you were sent? So the second appendix that that Erica sent to you was from the Education Review Office. Now, this was in April, so only a couple of months ago. So in April, she had commissioned them to do a review of RSE. Now, we just put a Substack out about this just this morning. So she has commissioned ERO as one of the pieces, but I can't find any information about what their full inquiry looks like. So as far as if it's bigger than just using ERO. Now, ERO is a separate organisation to the Ministry of Education. And so the review is of how RSE is currently taught and how well it meets the needs of students, expectations of parents and capability of schools. So they lay out in here what this is. And they say that the field work was going to begin in June. And then all of a sudden this week we found it. So we've got a couple of parents that have contacted us whose schools have said, yes, we've been chosen by ERO to do this review. So ERO are going in and interviewing in 20 schools. We've got 2,500 plus schools in New Zealand. They're going into 20 schools and then they're doing a online only survey to 500 schools. So we say, if you are a parent in school and you see that your school is participating, please get along or please contribute to the survey. But we've also been given a copy of all the questions of the surveys, which includes the student survey. And I believe that the survey is of poor quality. I believe that it is loading the bases to not give people the opportunity to say what they really want to say. And I am concerned that they have handpicked the 20 schools that they're going to consult into, that they will try and throw data that probably isn't representative of how big this issue is.
Have you the list of the schools?
Don't have the list of the schools, and I doubt that they would put them out, but we have, of the 20 schools, we already know two schools because we know people in our networks around the country who have said, yep, we've just had the call in. So one of them has done it. They did it a couple of weeks ago, and the feedback was that only about 5 parents showed up. So again, most parents just aren't aware of how big a deal this is to make this a priority. But all bar one of the parents were saying how concerned that they were with the current curriculum, and apparently the ERO staff that were there recording all of this were quite horrified at what they heard. It's like they didn't even know that this was a thing. So yeah, I have concerns about how that survey is going to roll and how the information is going to be interpreted based on who is driving this at the moment. And you've only got to go and have a look at the ERO website itself, and it's loaded with stuff that's pro all of this narrative as well.
It's the COVID era academic experts all over again.
It is, yeah, it is. And we're on the outside knocking at it going, we can see what's going on, we can see what's going on, and why are these people that we aren't sure whether they've really got the best interests of the truth at heart and actually the best interests of the well-being of all children.
Is there anything else in those appendices that I never looked at?
The problem that they're talking about is they're basically loading this ERO one with the reasons why they did the last consultation and change, which is that we need to be more diverse and inclusive. So they're already loading it with their ideology, which kind of tells you where they're at.
Mm.
I look
because
at it
because they live in a total bubble.
Yeah, and they live in a world where this is the norm.
Yeah,
and people like us are extreme conservatives or whatever they want to call us, and there doesn't appear to be a good body of people, of parents, that can get their say in the door. The peak body that used to be parents' voice with the Ministry of Education was, of course, the School Trustees Association. Now, anyone who's been on a board in the last few years like me or is on the board now will find that they're not allowed to bring their voice. They just get told what to do. So you've got a problem at the top there if you've got a bunch of stakeholders and one of them, the one that's supposed to be parent voice, is the School Trustees Association, because they're just order followers. They're just pushing the policies down the pipe. They're not giving parents who are on the board, who have been voted in by their peers, the opportunity to effect change.
We need half a dozen people to be tagged to each school in New Zealand and to be part of our network, and we would save our kids.
That's what I believe could be a step towards this, is having a cohort of parents at as many schools as we can that become a little group called Parent Voice for their school.
Yeah.
And they can go and consult themselves. See, we're stuck at the moment because all the consultation and all of the communication, all of the meetings are generated through the school. But if we flip that and we generate it through the community around the school, I've always felt that that's what we need to do now. We can't just sit there and wait for them to provide us with the solution. But it's not about going in angry. It's about getting together with enough parents that care and understanding what's going on and asking the intelligent questions so that we can understand. And we go in and try and help. I honestly believe that this information that we've uncovered through this OIA, parents should be using it to go in and help the schools.
Mm.
They should be going, so, look, we know you're uncomfortable. We hear it all the time that teachers are uncomfortable teaching this topic. It's quite a simple thing for them to go in and go, look, back in December, the Ministry of Education told Erica Stanford that it's not compulsory, so let's get it gone quickly before more children are harmed with this ideology. So if we had parents at each school or at enough schools that would work together, would talk to us, we would help them, we would show them the data, we'd give them guidance, and then help them to have empowering conversations to help their school leaders.
Mm. I'm talking with Penny Marie from Let Kids Be Kids. As I said at the start, I got to declare my interest because I think she's wonderful and a great leader and a saver of our children, and I'm helping her as a soldier. Now tell me, Penny Marie, for listeners, how do they find out and how do they sign up to Let Kids Be Kids, our listeners?
Okay, so the easiest way is just go to our website, letkidsbekids.nz, and we have a Substack, so you'll find that in the main menu if you want to sign up for our emails. And then we're also across social media, so you'll find all the links on letkidsbekids.nz. And we'd love to hear from you. We are setting up regional groups around the country so that people can find each other in their towns and schools.
And I'm the Queenstown person.
You're the Queenstown person, yeah.
I love it. So I've got two things to do following this interview. One is I'm going to fire an OIA off to Mr. Luxon, and I'm going to add in if he's had any communication with Mr. Peters about this vex issue too. And second of all, I'm going to fire a note off to the chairman of our local high school and say, look, none of this is compulsory.
Yeah.
And send him the appendix. Penny Marie of Let Kids Be Kids, God give you strength, because you are truly doing God's work here on earth. And there's a special place in heaven for those who stand up for our kids. And speaking on behalf of my family and all our listeners, we honour you and respect you and we bless you.
Thanks, Rodney. Same with you. You're amazing.
That was Penny Marie, Let Kids Be Kids. Go to the website. What a cause. It's a tough conversation. It's a tough questions. It's tough. It's hard. But we have to do it. Why? Because our kids are being literally destroyed. They're being destroyed by hypersexualization, by a dreadful critical gender theory that suggests that sex is just a social construct, that families are old hat. And our lovely teachers, rainbow washed, my new phrase, into doing this. Our companies are rainbow washed. And who's it hurting? Everyone, but especially our kids. And if there's one thing that we know we're on earth for, it's to look after kids. We're not doing it. Go to Let Kids Be Kids webpage, sign up to the Substack, join and become aware of what's happening in your local school. Thank you so much for listening. You're on Rally Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. You can send me a text at 2057. You can email me at inbox@rallycheck.radio.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.